Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Poets Dave Casario and Martin Farawell have been bouncing ideas off of one another since the 1980s, when they were in the graduate writing program at NYU.
Over the years, they've remained friends, poetic confidants, and muses for one another. Casario now lives in Billings, and Farawell in Pennsylvania with his wife, Cheryl Solomini.
Farawell is the director of the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival, held every 2 years in Newark, New Jersey, and Solomini is a journalist and novelist.
The couple recently came to Montana for a visit, and they took a pause in their vacation to come into the YPR studios. They had just come off a road trip to Yellowstone Park that took a long detour, so they were a bit road weary, but in good spirits.
How you feeling, Dave? Feeling just, good?
Yeah.
You look really serious. You brought some notes.
Oh, I did, because my memory and brain are just driving and fried.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks, guys, for hopping in. Now, you've been friends for quite a long while. Tell me how you all met.
New York City, actually, NYU, in the writing program, 85, right? Galway's Canals,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Workshop. No, 86.
We're in 86. Yes.
Yeah, spring. Yeah, the winter 86 one. Yeah.
Yeah, you were studying at the time with poetic greats. You mentioned Galway Canal. I know Dave.
Galway. He may be dead, but he still doesn't like his name pronounced properly.
I knew I was going to butcher somebody's name. It might as well be a poetic great. And Sharon Olds, too. Tell me about poetry in New York at that time.
Well, I went to NYU because Galway Canal was teaching there. I was looking into writing programs all over. And I wanted to go someplace where there was a teacher who would terrify me. And he was a talent whose work really intimidated me. And New York, there were open mics and reading series just all over the place. The whole kind of MFA world was new then. I think there were maybe a dozen MFA programs around the country. So there was kind of an excitement about being there in that program. And because Galway was the founder of that program, he was really interested in poets, young poets, who were not just out of college, you know, who had some life experience. I think the average age of people coming into the program was in their late 20s, early 30s, mid 30s, 40s. And he was not there to run, you know, a career seminar. He was really deeply engaged in the really profound nature of the art.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's changed a lot in the last 30 years, but he designed the program to really get deep into the work. And that's most of the New York scene I was engaged in.
Yeah, as well. You know, and that those workshops experiences, I was never in a workshop before that, except for Sharon Olds' workshop the first time. But that level of respect. You know, it's a bit like a musician. You know, if someone's just laying down something really hot, you want to top it, but not out of, you know, a bad sense of competition. But how did they just do that? Or they just sang something. It stuck something. It's, you know, struck something inside me. I want to sing that out. How did that happen? How can I do that? And so, while there was competition, it was positive competition for the most part. And both Sharon and Galway, that's how they ran the workshops. And just talking to other people from other writing programs in the area. I won't name them necessarily. The competition, it was sort of cutthroat, not very helpful, you know. So
So how did that influence your work? I know that that time period is really reflective in your poetry even today.
Well, it gave you permission, I think, to go into things that are embarrassing. I remember one time, we would have the private conferences with Galway and everything after workshops. And I was one poem I was working on, I said, is this just indulgent, you know? And he's like, he just stopped and looked at me and just went, no. Or I didn't even say no, he just looked at me and went back to the poem. You know, it's like, what, are you an idiot, you know? I mean, he didn't really say those things to you, but, you know, he took it serious.
Well, it feels validating
in that
insecurity.
Yeah.
You kind of felt like you were being taken very seriously.
Yeah, and you're especially kind of the work we were starting to work on, you know. I remember when we first met, we were talking about a lot of family poetry was starting to come up for me, and I think it was coming up for you at the time. Mm-hmm. And how do you get at that? You know, it's not therapy, you know. It's like you're trying to make art out of this experience, and how do you make it sing without being, you know, sentimental or just trying to make something out of nothing, like making a musical out of something that shouldn't be made a musical out of.
You know? Yeah.
So.
Well, David, your work does take on more of a performative aspect. Your poetry lives off of the page. When did you get into performance-based poetry?
I think I always had been, without even knowing that's what I was doing. Because I don't think of myself as a performance poet. I don't think of myself as a slam poet. Someone was asking me about this the other day, about, I think maybe perhaps we were having a conversation about mm-hmm. the Dreyfus, about the idea of the bardic notion of poetry.
Yes.
And I think my response for that was that even though poetry is often a solitary occupation, as it were, or preoccupation, poets have public roles, you know, and so that's why I think of it, you know. And we're as part of the tradition as old as human beings. And you share those ideas,
yeah,
too.
I would say Dave's a poet. You know, this term performance poet is very young. 30 years it's been around, maybe. Yeah. Poetry's been around 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. The tradition, which all modern poetry comes out of, is an oral tradition. And poetry was passed on generations, as Dave just said, thousands of years. Generations to generations through the oral tradition. People knew poems, recited poems, had poems by heart, who were illiterate. They only knew it as the sound in their ear. They only knew it from the connection with the person saying it. It was this direct transmission mm-hmm. that they experienced. It struck me as very odd when this term performance poet started being used, because that's Homer. That's who the speaker of Beowulf. That's this is the tradition that the maker of the poem was the singer of the poem. And this distinction between a poet and a performance poet is really very new. And I think it comes out of the kind of rise of academic poetry in post-World War II America. Mm-hmm. Because before then, even people's grandmothers, working people, knew poems by heart, shared them in the family. So I think performance poets are, in fact, going back to the tradition. They're not new. They're touching something very deep. C.K. Williams, who just died recently, a wonderful American poet, said at some point, I'm going to have to paraphrase this, but he said that the poem is the greatest human invention for getting inside someone else's state of mind. That may not be 100% true, but it's a really good idea. Mm-hmm. And I think on some level, the poems that really get to us, there is that feeling of really being inside someone else's mind and experience and feeling that connection with someone you may never meet face to face. But there's that really intimate, direct human connection that makes you feel not alone. Even if you are literally alone in your room reading a book of poems, mm-hmm. there's that exchange of idea and experience.
Yeah.
Regarding the Dodge Festival, what I'm curious about, getting poets together in the largest collection of poetry, I suppose, in the nation, what's it like?
Cool. It's cool, yeah. Well, to go back to high school student day, there's 4,000 or 5,000 high school students who come for free with their teachers. We have 60 poets from all across the country, sometimes other countries, who come and meet with them. And it's outside the classroom. It's not academic. They're not being taught how to write. They're not being taught how to read a poem. They're not being taught anything that they might learn in a typical literature course. What they had the opportunity to do is meet poets face to face as human beings. And the discussions, the Q&As that go on are more intimate, personal, relaxed, funny than probably any other opportunity the poets have to talk about their work, because typically they're put in this pigeonhole of needing to teach, or to teach writing, or to teach other writers. And this is one of the few places where they get to be poets talking about people who are interested in them and their work. And it's joyous. It's a celebration. There are poets who meet there who don't know each other, have never met, from different generations, mm-hmm. who are friends for decades after. And one of the beauties of that is that the students who come, who are 16, 17, will walk into a space, and there's a panel talk, and there are poets in their 80s, their 50s, their 20s, from all different ethnic, social backgrounds. And what they'll see that I think is most important is how that wide range of poets you'd think would have nothing to do with each other, the kind of respect for each other, the affection for each other. And to me, that goes a long way in opening the kids up to broader notions of what a poem is, mm-hmm. Beyond some very narrow academic sense, or with the one kind of poem they might like walking in the door.
Yeah.
You know, when they see a 28-year-old rap poet talking to 83-year-old Marie Ponceau as you know, and they're very excited about each other's, you know, input, that changes your perception of the art. And that's, I think that's really important.
And Dave, do you see that when you work with high school students here in Billings, that poetry sort of opens up new avenues or friendships for them?
Yeah, I think it can, you know, I think it does. I mean, I'm excited about working with the fourth graders that we get to work with Arts Without Boundaries. But the high school students sometimes are tougher because, particularly if in the classroom, they you know, because they're not necessarily, the students we work with aren't the ones that are there for poetry. They're there, and suddenly they have to deal with poetry or something like, oh, well, we got to do this. You know, they're making a lot of complaining noises.
Because maybe they didn't have a relationship with it before.
Well, I don't know exactly. But when they start to do it, and the last writing project we did, called Worlds Apart But Not Strangers. And that had over 150 students contributing to this, and we turned it into a long poem, but it's a performance poem, a theater piece, and then it got turned over to the theater students and Margot Turley at Senior, and they performed it. And I take sections of those poems when I do things with Humanities Montana, and it translates so well. The things those kids are talking about just cut right to it to the other students who don't even know them. They could be somebody up in Kalispell, you know, and they hear this and they're like, you can write that about, you can, that's poetry, you know. So it does, you know, you just kind of get past that veneer.
You know? Well, and you mentioned your work with Arts Without Boundaries, and we're both very fortunate to be able to work with grade school students, third through fifth grade, and some of the elementary schools throughout Billings. And you find that they perhaps don't have an understanding that they contain poetry, and we're just giving them these techniques to bring it out, but that poems really live within them. And I think that they are all very surprised when they find out that they're a poet.
Oh, yeah. They just, you know. And there was one, we brought Parker Brown in to play music. So we play music, and the kids write, the fourth graders write while the music's playing. And then they have to get up and read their poems, you know. And so and I gave him the option, Parker can play with you, you know, while you're reading if you want. And some took it up, and one student gets up and he goes, play it sad. And then, I mean, he laid it down. I mean, I should have brought that poem with. I mean, you would have gone, really? That's, I wished I wrote some of that.
I know. They just don't contain the filters or the self-criticism yet that we do. They're just very organic in what they put on the page. I had one student draw me a drawing as a thank you, and it was a picture of me crying. And he said, this is you crying because my poems are so sad. Thank you. And he did. He was really processing complex emotions in that moment and things that maybe he didn't know he had the tools to do. And when they put it down on page, there's something so therapeutic and relieving to speaking your truth. And I think poetry cuts to the very core of our truths.
I think one of the differences between younger students and high school students is that when they get to high school, kids are tested on their understanding. You know, there's one interpretation of a poem that they're supposed to guess, you know. And it's tied so much to learning specific English language skills. So all that kind of personal connection to it is sublimated to this other test, which is considered superior, which is teaching these specific set of skills, like the definition of iambic pentameter. I mean, some of the tests that my nieces and nephews show me very excitedly that they were given on their poetry unit make me sick. And it's so backwards. Mm-hmm. It's so backwards. So what it does is it puts all the value on the intellectual understanding, which devalues the personal connection. And of course, nobody stays engaged in an art for their lifetime because of their intellectual understanding of it. It's got to mean something to them. It's got to speak to them. So
it's got to have that gut.
Yeah, it's got to mean, you know. Otherwise, it's a crossword puzzle. Mm-hmm. Which can be a lot of fun, but not to disparage crossword puzzles, you know, but it's a very different thing. So that's a big part of our work, is actually to give kids permission to experience that connection again, and it's whether they only read it or write it. So it's open to kids who just want to kind of rediscover the connection. that they can have poetry in their lives for the rest of their lives, even if they never want to write a poem in their lives. They have it there for themselves.
And Cheryl, you've worked as an editor with different magazines dealing with young students, right?
Well, I worked with Highlights for Children magazine for quite a while. And, you know, one of the things that they tried to do was to make the stories relatable for the kids and not be it a lesson. Mm-hmm. And we definitely tried to edit things to be fun, but yet there was a message to be had there. Yeah. I mean, actually, we've talked about this at home with poetry and other things, that if you were asked to dissect a sitcom about what the jokes mean and how they build up, would you be sitting home watching a sitcom? We wouldn't be entertaining anymore. So you really work for entertaining. And even when I wrote for magazines, I mean, one of the reasons I have longevity in that is that I made it into a story. You know, I'd start out with a personal story and maybe give health information or do whatever to bring it, you know, almost full circle sometimes, but to engage them in some other way so that this whatever kind of very practical information you were trying to impart would be engaging right up front. And even, you know, with the shorter the piece, the harder you have to work on getting that. And I even used alliteration and various other poetic things in order to kind of pump it up. And I love verbs, and verbs do so much of the heavy lifting. If you just find the perfect verb, You don't need a whole lot of other words.
That's true.
Now, Cheryl, you work as a professional writer in a variety of roles, editor, journalist, novelist. Dave was describing your relationship to me, and he said, "Her life as a writer is a practical guide for the dreamer in me." And I loved that combination because I think we have to have both the practicality, the intellectual understanding, and yet that gut response, that white-hot center that Robert Butler talks about when you write fiction, or even when you share your world with other people. Tell me about, you know, making a living as a writer and balancing those aspects.
Well, I stand on a highway with a sign that says, we'll write for food. So I said, also, in the last year, I've been doing improv, and one of course, the most basic is yes and. So if somebody calls me up and says, would you like to write about French tip nails? Yes. I've never had a manicure, but I'll write about it. And, you know, there's always something to be learned, especially, you know, if you're curious. Anything you do, especially for a journalist, is that you're learning something new. It's not because you know it already. It's because you're learning something new, and eventually it may work out into some other piece or even a fiction piece. I mean, there's been a couple of the first children's story I wrote was because I was in a tutorial for a software program. And so they're just saying, oh, type something in. So I wrote, "The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog." And then as I'm typing, all of a sudden, the dog jumped in and said, "Who are you calling lazy?" And so I wrote a whole short story for kids based on the fox and who was writing this, and a lizard who was taking this all down and saying, "I'm just trying to find the letters of the alphabet." And it took off from there. But you never know what you're doing that's going to lead into something else, a piece of factual information, or just being tired and lazy, or whatever else is going on in your life, could be an object of curiosity that you follow to the end.
Yeah, that idea of maybe of informed curiosity. The more you go down the rabbit hole, the more that you find that there's a story in everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like the writing life.
The rabbit hole and the sign will work.
As one of my teachers said, pay attention to your paying attention. So if there's something that crosses your path that strikes you, make note of why it's stopping your attention, and that could be the basis of something.
Yeah. Well, and I think that as poets, we're always pulling from the places that catch our eye, and so you've got to be paying attention, or else, you know, a lot of things get glazed over. Mm-hmm. Now, Dave, you published This Vanishing in 2014, and it's very reflective of your time in New York City. There's a lot of work there, but also just the poems that you created as you evolved. Tell me a little bit about how you came to publish This Vanishing.
Well, in truth, I had the manuscript working on it off and on for quite some time, and Martin was one of the first readers of that manuscript and gave me a lot of really good advice, you know. But then I put, you know, you enter contests as a poet, right? And you spend a lot of money on those contest fees. And the chances are there's a lot of good poems out there, you know, and manuscripts. And you might get it, you might not. And I've come close, but, you know, and so finally I just, frustrated, put it away, put it back in the drawer. And then Tammy Holland, we were talking, she goes, "What is your manuscript out?" No. Well, why not? You know, and then she goes, "Well, try this publisher," you know. And so I sent it to them, and it got done. But basically, she's just like, you know, well, you can keep it in the drawer, you can keep it out. And so kept sending it out, and this one worked.
Ah. You have described Martin as one of the few people you trust absolutely to tell you what he thinks about your work.
So yeah, I do, yeah.
It's a vulnerable space to open up your work that hasn't necessarily seen the air or other people. How does it feel, or what are the qualities of a good editor?
That I don't know. I truly don't. You know, I mean, it's other than what you said, maybe telling the truth, you know, and the funny thing is that a lot of the times when we did a lot of this work, it wasn't electronic, you know. We were sending it back and forth in letters and the manuscript and paper and seeing handwriting and notation. And it's like, it's funny because I think I inherited this from my mother. She left England when she was very young. Well, not very young, 18, but, you know, 19. And then with, you know, started a family in Chicago, and she would wait for these letters, right? And letters were just a connection back to something. And I've always loved letters. And so the idea of people writing to each other and then picking this up and getting it in the mail, you know, and they're going to talk about my poetry, you know, you know, or vice versa, or what happened to you. I mean, I felt the same way when I went to Goddard and did monthly mailings, you know. Now everything, it's on computer, right? So you still get the same thing, but it isn't the same of, is it in the mail today? Oh, wow, here's a package. I can sit down with this, you know.
Well, Dave, I would be very honored if you would share a few of your poems with us from sure. This Vanishing.
Okay. Well, then I might share one or two from that, or maybe just one from that, and then one from that's a little newer.
Yeah, maybe whatever
the,
you've
maybe
got.
Maybe the one that Martin and Cheryl never have heard before. So
Right. The
one that I was thinking about was that it's probably, I think, maybe the first poem maybe that Martin heard me read, and it was in the workshop, and it was one of the first poems when people could say, oh, how did you start writing poetry? And, you know, you say, well, man, since I was, I don't know, 7 or 8 or whenever you first thought about that. But I wasn't until I was 30 where I wrote a poem where I felt you couldn't take this away from me. You know, I don't mean that it's the best poem ever or, you know, or anything like that, but it was something real and fundamental. And I felt like I literally crossed over and stepped over it. So it's like in writing it, just I stepped over and I could feel it. And you know, that's hard to quantify or prove, but I knew it was different because I'd been writing since, well, that's 14, 20 years, something like that at that point. And so anyway, but in the workshop, the idea of Martin saying, you know, about people's advice. And I remember Galway said this was kind of a wobbly poem, but he liked it. It seemed like he was pulling for it. But at the same, you know, in the sense that he could see that there was something there, right? And so it later in my head, wobbly, well, that's like a colt. A colt gets up. It's still a horse. It's wobbly. It ain't going to go run around real fast, but it's a horse.
Right.
It's not a turtle, you know? And, you know, and so, and then, but the other thing too is I think where we got the connection was that people were kind of, he said wobbly, so everybody started going on wobbly and focusing on that and picking at it and saying this, and Martin saw the part that was basically what he was just talking about. This, he was getting what was going on in the poem, you know, the experience. And so in a sense he stuck up for me, but not out of fairness or out of anything like that, but like, no, this is what I see, and you know, I think that these criticisms are inaccurate, you know, and that's the thing that I appreciate, why I trust him, because, you know, we may not agree. He may make, you know, Martin, often through the years, we've made comments on each poem, and it's like, well, we didn't change them because we said that, but it allowed us to see it in a certain way. Mm-hmm. So that's why I read this poem, so not because it's a great poem or anything like that, but it has an emotional appeal to people that I almost didn't put into the book because I was like, you know, that's a little sentimental, and, you know, and it's not that good, and I'm picking holes at it, you know. So anyway, so that's the caveat to it. And it's about my mother, Muriel. Muriel. My mother held out for tangerines. They were more willing than the orange, rare as China still, and carried the thought which was never spoken, that life was no more than that. Peeling them now in the darkened kitchen, the taste of them almost in my mouth. A mouth forged from the soft melding of two others slipping open like caves found in darkness, moistening the sweet, heavy air that fell between them with the thought that was never spoken. my thumbs, and to the skin no differently than did those in the hands of my father, unbinding slowly for the first time her shoulders, more willing than oranges, and found a fruit rare as China still. And for some reason, it made me emotional.
Wow, and thank you. That was very lovely. Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna interrupt for a
sure.
second.
Yeah, feel free
to say.
You should have fixed this. I told you 7 years ago. No.
These lines. No, I want to say that, you know, Dave. He said some rather modest things about not putting it in the book. So
I was serious though. I wasn't being.
Yeah,
honest.
But I want to just as another poet, I just want to say, listen to this. My mother held out for tangerines. Just by itself, you know, nothing that's coming. Any poet would give their eye teeth for that opening line.
We're all nodding.
I guess, yeah. You know,
yeah, I got a little tear here.
I mean, it's just so perfect. And then it's, my mother held out for tangerines. They were more willing than the orange. You're already gone somewhere else. And yet you don't know where the poem is going. Rare as China still. And carried a thought, which was never spoken, that life was no more than that. So what starts out is really, apparently, possibly a very simple poem about liking oranges, comes to this profound thing. Life was no more than that. The pleasure of eating a tangerine instead of an orange. Forgive me for the,
no,
the interpretation.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah.
Or the momentary existence of it.
So
simple. It's appealed and gone.
Yes. And it starts out so simple and seductive, like, my mother held out for oranges. It's packed with so much possibility.
Like tangerines.
And then it goes into this really deep, dark, and beautiful place of understanding what his father first saw in his mother, and something really like heartbreaking. To me, this is part of the power of Dave's work and the power of really great poems, mm-hmm. is that they start with something you take for granted, something you see every day, something you may not even think about normally. And then something happens. You're alone in your kitchen peeling an orange, and suddenly this memory comes from the smell of the orange. And you remember, my mother held out for tangerines. Yeah. And it takes you somewhere. But the challenge and the hard work is, you know, is to not just make it about, I remember liking orange. My mother liked oranges. Yeah. But where does the sense memory, where does this take you? And whether or not you have the courage to go where it takes you. And that's the hard work, and that's what Dave does. He does the hard work.
All right, let's hear another one, Dave.
So this one's kind of new, and we'll see how it goes, and I don't even know. But it's actually, we'll stick to the mother. My mother is on, and so my mom died 2012, and then, but how that comes back, right? You know, and then the smallest things will trigger it. And so this one actually got triggered right by our Pioneer Park. and so it's called The Crossing. Mom. A girl today, 7, 8 years old, at the four-way stop at the top of Pioneer Park. Everyone, the traffic, 2 and 3 deep, even the gaggle of ducks whose corner this is, are paused in a pack at the empty square of intersection, waiting for her. She, who does not know why we are waiting, only that we are all patient together. And then she does know. It's her. She is the one who holds us, keeps us, that each of us will not move until she is safely across. I cried for you then. I could not stop. Even as she ran, grinning through the crosswalk, knowing, it seems, what a child must know, how it is to be loved, that each of us, on our way to somewhere else, is a blessing to be waited upon.
Thank you so much. What a lovely poem.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing. I'm just incredibly inspired and honored to be in the presence of you all. You've done such great work. Thank you again for being here, Dave.
Thanks. It's great.
Martin, Cheryl, thanks for being here.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.